This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. This year, we were invited to return to the Beavertown Extravaganza to run the now annual Symposium, bringing together brewers and leaders from all over the world to discuss the topics of the day, some of which inspire the industry, and some that keep it up at night. Last year's first ever symposium for the Extravaganza covered the spread from Terroir and beer to hazy IPA, and this year was no less ambitious. But the context for this year's symposium naturally shifted, as Beavertown's own ambitions came to light in the months leading up to their minority partnership with Heineken and the announcement of Beaverworld. Some brewers took offense and pulled out, others soldiered on, and still others rallied to their side and joined the festival, sending a clear message that, as the beer industry continues to evolve and grow more complex, the simple notions that once seemed to spur it on are perhaps not as simple as many thought after all. The topics for this year's extravaganza followed naturally on that signal, covering topics such as how beer and wine are sold differently, the value of independence and investment, and of course, what is going to happen to Hazy IPA after all this. Congrats to Beavertown and their crew for forging ahead and throwing a spectacular event in the midst of a challenging time of change. Thanks for inviting us to come and co-host the symposium with you all. After all, the purpose of the symposium is to dig into these issues, not shy away from them, and that's exactly what we did. You'll hear from a number of GBH team members hosting these talks, and I'm quite proud of that. Our UK team is growing and our bench is deep. So for some of you, it'll be the first time you've heard from folks like Chris Hall, Johnny Garrett, and Claire Bullen, all led by our UK editor, Matthew Curtis. But it surely won't be the last. This episode is called Food for Thought. Where does beer and restaurant culture intersect? Why have restaurants been so slow to recognize modern beer's place at the table? And why do their beer menus lag so far behind wine menus? Who are the folks that are doing interesting things with beer in a hospitality context, and how are breweries working alongside restaurants? From house beers to education and staff training and beyond. And what will restaurants' beer offerings look like in 5 years' time? This is hosted by GBH's Claire Bullen, with panelists Johnny Hamilton of Beavertown, Travis Hickson of Blackberry Farm, and Dan Nathan from Beef and Brew. Listen in.
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Claire Bullen. I'm a writer with Good Beer Hunting. I also do a fair amount of food and recipe development work. I actually have my first ever cookbook coming out next spring, which I wrote with Hot Burns and Black, and which is all about food and beer pairings. So this today's topic is near and dear to my heart. Today we're going to be talking all about the ways in which beer and restaurant cultures intersect and the ways in which they really don't, and why beer has lagged behind wine for so long in a dining context and what it can try to do to catch up. So please join me in welcoming our wonderful panelists for today. We've got Dan Nathan, who's here with Beef and Brew, which has two different sites across London. Give him a warm round of applause. We've got Travis Hickson here, who's the brewmaster of Blackberry Farm from Tennessee. And we've got Johnny Hamilton, who heads up the Tempest Project at Beavertown. So thanks so much for joining us today, guys. Dan, I'm going to put you on the spot for this first one. My first question is about Beef and Brew, because you're sort of an interesting case. When you opened a few years ago, you were one of the only restaurants in London to really put beer at the center of your mission statement. It's right there in the name. So a lot of restaurants feel like they're playing catch up and kind of adding on beer belatedly, but beer was always an important thing for you guys. So I wanted to ask if you could kind of bring us back to those early days for the business and talk about how you conceived of getting beer involved, why it was important for you, how you wanted to stand out.
Well, I think, as with any business, they're a reflection of the people that set them up. And you know, when I set the business up with my co-founder, Jess, what we wanted to do was serve really great quality beef at a great price point, really good value. And we also wanted to have great quality beer with that. And the main reason for it is Jess had set up a restaurant in a brewery. She cooked with beer lots, and she really enjoyed it as a product. And I really enjoyed it. And we just felt that there weren't any restaurants out there that really had it as central to what they did. And I guess the other thing is that, you know, if you look at restaurants and the general culture within the UK, like, wine can be quite aspirational. It can also be quite a scary product. And I think that beer is something that's incredibly democratic. You know, virtually everyone is going to, you know, who loves a steak is also loves drinking beer. And we very much felt that actually putting it central to what we did really summed it up. It was about quality, it's about value, but it's also about accessibility.
And you recently expanded to a second site, which kind of poetically is where Duke's Brew & Q used to be in Haggerston, and that's where Beavertown got its start. So how has expanding to that second larger site kind of expanded your beer offerings as well, and were you sort of conscious of that?
Yeah, very much so. I think that actually, you know, in a small site, it's really hard to have a really good draft beer offering just because you don't have the physical space. And I think, you know, if you look at the framing of the question that you've got on this panel, it's about, you know, restaurants and beer generally. And the thing that I find most interesting to that is that if you look at the explosion of craft beer and generally sort of gastropubs, where the quality of food in pubs, which are the second living room of, you know, people in the UK for, you know, centuries, they've both really boomed in the last sort of 20 years. The quality of food's got better in gastropubs.
There's a lot of crossover.
Right, there's a lot of crossover. And actually, it's a really natural thing. If you want to have good quality food and good quality beer, putting that in an environment, in a pub environment, is like such an obvious step. So when we were looking for our second site, it was really important to have the physical size to do justice to the beer, but also do it somewhere that people felt very comfortable going for a beer. And I felt that, you know, Duke's was perfect, because what was Duke's, it's no longer Duke's, because people went in and they knew that they could get great beer, but you also, that division between beer and food was really kind of obvious in the space. So that's why we picked that site.
Yeah, and even though it does have that sort of pubby vibe, but it is still distinct, it is still a restaurant. I think maybe we're still kind of coming up with the vocabulary to describe that, because we don't have a lot of models.
Yeah, it's true. You know, I was struggling. I was actually really at pains not to call it a gastropub.
That's the norm, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, what do you call it, a steak pub or a restaurant pub? I mean, it's difficult. There isn't the vocabulary there to describe it. But really, we wanted somewhere that had that kind of, you know, focus on great quality craft beer and a restaurant as well. And, you know, doing that within one space. And there are lots of places that do it. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what we call ourselves. I say restaurant pub.
Restaurant pub.
But, you know.
How do you bring beer into the menu? What are the kind of tools you use to kind of educate consumers or get them interested or really emphasize a beer as a key part of the program here?
Sure. I mean, there's a physical bit of physically putting beer in the food that you make.
Yep.
And you know, we'll talk to customers about that. And then there's the other bit of suggesting what they drink when they eat. But I'm also really aware that we're casual dining. And if you're casual dining, actually being sort of trying to dictate what someone eats and turn it into a more formal dining occasion where you say, like, pair this with that, turns it into something a little bit more formal than what you expect when you go for kind of a really good quality but really kind of fun casual experience.
Yep.
So, you know, what we do is we leave it to the servers, we train them, and we make sure that if someone's interested, we say, you know, if you're having a steak, why don't you go something malty? If you're having, you know, a dessert, why don't you try sort of like a breakfast type stout or something like that, you know? So they know how to impart that knowledge.
So there's a lot of education coming from the staff. That's kind of a key part of the program.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we used to put it on the menu, and we will do that going forward as well, but to a lesser extent, because I don't want to take away from that relaxed, casual vibe that you get in our restaurant and in lots of other places too.
Makes sense. So Travis, I wanted to talk to you next. You're kind of coming from the opposite perspective at Blackberry Farm, because you already had this kind of destination country resort come restaurant, and the brewery sort of came about later. So can you talk about how, I know you weren't there then, but you probably are educated in the story of how this brewery came to be, what kind of gap was it filling, and why did they decide to kind of add that to the offerings?
Well, the farm is there. It's been there 40 years now, and very well known for the cuisine, the wine and everything. And so our founder saw a, you know, been in brewing, is you know, huge beer fan, and he just said, "Well, this is a missing thing. Like, this needs to happen." So, went to the farm, talked to them about it, and at the time they were adding. So for 20 years, probably not a lot of change going on there, and our late proprietor Sam Bell added the cheese program, charcuterie butchery. You know, a lot of the gardens and all that that kind of thing, and so, you know, it was a natural fit.
Was that demand really coming from the clientele?
No, not really. I'm not sure that, you know, how much they considered it before until Roy brought up the idea, and you know. You know, when you look at the whole panorama of everything that goes on there, it's just, it's a no-brainer, you know.
And you guys now have a production facility that's, you know, a 15-minute drive away from your main headquarters. But what is that relationship like? Are you still brewing on site as well?
We do the original breweries, kind of the R&D brewery now. It's a nano brewery, essentially, just brewing 4 or 5 days a week just to supply the farm and the neighboring community. And so we still brew on that to develop new recipes and things like that. Yeah.
You speak about R&D, and I kind of I want to talk more about that process, because I think one thing that sets Blackberry Farm apart is that you seem very conscious of how you want your beer to be integrated into your culinary offerings. Mm-hmm. It seems like making food-friendly beer is a big part of your ethos. And I think that's quite unique among breweries. And do you then, when you're coming up with recipes and testing things out, are you reverse engineering to create beers that go with specific flavors and ingredients? Or what is that kind of collaborative process like?
Well, you know, I don't know that we reverse engineer based on certain flavors always, but it's just a more maybe traditional viewpoint of balance, weight, how things might go. You know, it may be more of a general, like this would be a great beer at the beginning of a meal, as a, we've got aperitif or digestif. You know, it's more of a thing like, how does this weigh in? And you know, I don't know. We're not known for IPAs. But we do a few little draft only offerings,
Saisons.
But you know, our IPA might be like the IPAs I was just drinking in Belgium last week. You know, 45 IBUs or 50 maybe. You know, because after that we feel it tends to get out of balance with meals and overpower things, and so we don't want to do that. And we've done a lot of work with some restaurant groups and restaurateurs and chefs to collaborate with them. We had one that we did with one that had a fermented miso in house with rice and peas, and we incorporated that into a beer with spices, and you know, and it was, you know, only available to them, and you know, we've known them for a long time, and so we also have that connection where we have a lot of chefs come into the farm to do cooking demonstrations and, you know, special events and things like that, and then they say, well, can we work together maybe for some special beer for our restaurant, you know, and so we do some work like that as well, where sometimes they want to incorporate something that, you know, this chef's got an idea, he really wants to see if we can make this work in a beer, this, that, and the other, or sometimes it's just more of a, you know, sometimes it's ingredient based, and sometimes it's more of a, I don't want to say philosophical, but you know, it's more of a vague idea that we work together to interpret how that comes out in beer.
So there's a lot of opportunity to be really collaborative and flexible and creative. There's no kind of one way that you approach it every time.
Yeah. And event-wise, too, we do a lot of events that that wine's more the focus. That's just an area we feel is not well tapped, and it's more in line with our ethos and cuisine and all this. So Aspen Food and Wine, we were the first brewery to be presented there this year. Mm-hmm. Roy gave a talk there with our food and beverage director. So, you know, we just try and make some inroads on some areas that we feel, you know, aren't there. It's hard to make your inroads into, you know, 50 years of marketing girls in bikinis and sports events, you know, so it's not going to change overnight, and we feel like that kind of focus is...
Do you think you're making a difference in helpful. Providing a kind of visible model of what beer can do in a hospitality context that's totally different?
We don't think in terms of being a model, whether we are or not, I don't know, but that's just kind of our DNA, and it's the way we think, and it just suits more to what we do.
Mm-hmm. What kind of beer offerings do you have on site at the restaurant? Do you do pairing menus? Do you have Cicerones on site? How do you kind of bridge that gap with the clientele?
Well, we don't have Cicerones, but we have six or seven sommeliers. So, you know, it's kind of the same thing. And they know the beer. We have basically every bottled offering that we've made until it's gone. We have it in the cellar as well. So that's all available. And then we do some events over there, some you know, beer dinners and things like that too.
So there's a lot of guidance if people show up and they're like, I like beer, but I don't know where to start here.
Sure. Yeah.
Great. So Johnny, you have kind of an interesting perspective on this because you are a brewer first and foremost, but you also are someone who loves food and is very connected with the London dining scene. So as a brewer, when you go out to eat, what are you kind of expecting or hoping from a beverage program? Do you gravitate towards beer? Do you go for wine or natural wine or cocktails? What's your MO?
I gravitate towards wine, mainly because it's something that I'm kind of late to understanding. I'm getting into it and obviously finishing a day brewing and especially being surrounded by mixed fermentation stuff. And so our beers, you know, there's an escapism kind of like, I'm not going to do that. It's my day job, so I'm going to get into wine and pretty nerdy about that. But yeah, I see it as two different sides. Like one thing, I don't want beer to become, you know, high end and like, you know, this is beer. It has to be taken so seriously. But, you know, you get beer, which is, you know, a pint that you drink it by a pint, and you get beer that, you know, that I make on a daily basis, and I want to be taken as seriously as winemakers and as cider makers and as the restaurants themselves. So, you know, I go out, you know, sometimes I'm just, you know, I'm happy that to drink wine, and I look at the fridge, I'm just like, there's just like two beers in there. Why do we not have the same option? And other times I'm like, I'm kind of glad that beer is, you know, just that everyday kind of drinking beer. And there's definitely some restaurants that are like, you know, pizza, beer, you know, barbecue food, beer, but you want to go high dining, you want some small plates, some, you know, seafood, you know, it's very much like, here's the wine menu. And there's some restaurants in London that I love, like, that bridge that gap, you know, like the Marksman Pub. But when you go upstairs to the dining room, it's still very much like, you can take your pint of ale that you get downstairs, upstairs, and it's very much you know, pub dining kind of, but like high end. But here's the wine menu. It's kind of a bit of a weird disconnect, I find, that it's like Sunday lunch, you have a pint of ale. And then when you go to sit down, it's like red wine. And it's, I understand it and I appreciate that, you know, beer should be just, you know, you shouldn't get so serious about it, but I don't know. Sometimes when I go to things like raw wine, we had a stall there this year, and a lot of the people who are into wine would come up to the beer and be like, oh, thank God there's some beer here. I love beer. It's really good to cleanse the palate. I'm like, yeah, it's 2 year in a barrel. It was in an amphora or this. And it's just like, you know, I put in as much effort and, you know, like every producer here, like I wanted to be kind of seen in that kind of echelon and, you know, the appreciation of the craft. And it is
like beer's proxy to wine is basically with the kind of work you do. It takes years to make. It involves amphora and lots of traditional methods.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as craft gets, right? Mm. So but it should be treated with that respect.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a bit of a stab in the back when people are like, yeah, I just love, like, you know, really cleans the palate, and you're like, okay. But whereas I find that people in the beer world, this is just my opinion, obviously, that people have very different opinions, that people who get into wine from the beer world are kind of looking to try some predominantly natural or kind of they're interested in the culture behind it and the methods. And like when I try wine, I'm like, how do they make that? How do they achieve that? Whereas I find from the other side, it was very much like beer is beer, which, you know, it's hard because, you know, but at the end of the day, I drink a lot of wine, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But
there seems to be some interesting pushback coming from the brewing side of things too, in that a lot of brewers seem really worried about the winification of beer, and you kind of alluded to that. And I'm interested in that knee-jerk kind of repulsion from the idea of casting beer in a formal context or taking it seriously as a culinary object, because really, I think we'd all agree that beer works really well with food and is really versatile. So why do you think there is that pushback, and how can we elevate beer without reducing it to this kind of wine proxy? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I agree. There's loads of amazing dishes that work so much better with beer than wine. Dessert's a really good example you said earlier. I mean, how many people, even your average wine drinker, turn to dessert wine? It's very niche, whereas, you know, stout and things like that works, you know, like a really sweet beer, a barley wine can work really well. I don't know, I think especially in the UK, there's such a long history of cask beer, and you know, it's a, you know, by the pint, and it's a very different culture, is that people immediately, whenever you start talking about mixed fermentation and stuff, they're like, what are you talking about? It's just beer's beer, and that's it. And yeah, I mean, when I finish a week's work, I just want a pint of lager. Sometimes it's like the most nondescript beer. I think there is, but I think people, your average consumer who drinks, goes to a restaurant, a lot of the people aren't looking for a pairing. They're just like, a lot of people, I don't know, you can fill in more, but how many people go for the house, the wine, because they're there for the food, and the wine is, you know, it's just a wine to go alongside it. And then there's the people who are like looking for something that'll go really well. And I don't know, I think there's, yeah, I've kind of, gone off topic, but
yeah. But Dan, maybe you can speak to that audience breakdown. What percentage of people who come roughly are kind of plugged in and actively interested or asking questions? What percentage are like, just give me the house red?
A very large percentage just go for the house or the one up from it. And with beer, actually, people are more engaged, particularly in our second site, which is more beer focused. So they're coming to maybe try, you know, an interesting IPA. It'd be pretty rare that they go for, you know, 750ml bottle of something that's been barrel aged or something. But I think the interesting thing that you were saying that I really agree with is that there's a real difference between the casual dining scene and the fine dining scene. And in the casual dining scene, you know, beer is absolutely, you know, the preserve of that scene. You know, if you go to a, you know, say gastropub, or if you go to lots of breweries like Crate, etc., have started off brewing beer and then they started to incorporate street food, and it just seems like a natural pairing, because people are drinking good beer, but they'll drink it in a quite, you know, in a relaxed way. It just seems they just go hand in hand. It's when you get up to, and sorry, and if you go to somewhere like, you know, I'm trying to think of an average chain. If you think of someone like Byron, I was looking at their menu earlier on. You know, the beer list is actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. The wine list is not pretty good, but the beer list is pretty good. When you go to the high end, the problem is that, or higher end, doesn't necessarily have to be Michelin. The beer list is like not nearly as good. They might have some really good beers, but there'll be far fewer of them. You'll see like a really, really long wine list, because it, you know, naturally, if you go to a good restaurant, you think it's aspirational, and wine is also aspirational, and therefore that seems to be the natural fit in, you know, our culture. Beer is that everyday drink, wine is that aspirational drink. And the reality, of course, is that, you know, sometimes beer does go better with food than wine does, and vice versa. And I guess that, you know, the interesting thing will be happening, like, in 10 years when you have pairing lists, and I wonder if those pairing lists will be, you know, a mix of the two things. It's drinks pairing rather than wine pairing. And I know that you do get beer pairing in good restaurants now, many good restaurants, and you know, certainly it's something we've done. But generally, if you go to a good restaurant, the pairing list says wine pairing. It doesn't say drinks pairing. I think that's definitely something that we'll see a progress in.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think, from my perspective, the main problem is kind of that middle band. And there was a panel yesterday that kind of alluded to that. I think if you have sort of cheap and cheerful, people are happy to grab a can of pale ale or lager. And actually, we're seeing in a lot of really high-end fine dining restaurants that beer is sort of paradoxically finding its way in. So 11 Madison Park in New York, which was named the best restaurant in the world, beer is a key part of their menu. Noma has worked with Michelin and also has offered beer. Sure. In their old space now, there's a new bar called Bar, which is kind of a new Nordic version of a beer bar, but it has that really elevated cuisine with the beer pairings. So it seems that beer can flourish in this really high-end bracket where the customer isn't choosing, and where it's kind of woven seamlessly into this kind of prefix menu format. But it seems that beer has the biggest barrier to entry when people are ready to splash out and treat themselves and want something special, but they just don't see beer as special or worth the cost. So maybe this is a question for Johnny or for Travis. What do you think brewers can do in terms of packaging and optics, and try to make beer look more impressive when it comes to the table? Is there anything, is that something that brewers can even really control?
I think we're quite similar. I mean, our bottles are, you know, 375 mil champagne bottles. A lot of your stuff is, like, mostly 750s. It's you know, the Blackberry Farm stuff, not to speak for Travis, but is, you know, very nice typography and, you know, takes inspiration. Definitely when I see it, you know, the writing is, you know, kind of like inspired by wine. And you know, Nick kind of does a different job with our artwork to the main Beavertown stuff, which is, you know, very colorful and bold, and this stuff's more subtle and generally kind of monochrome or metallic effect. And, you know, it definitely looks the part. I think people, there is definitely, you know, when people get a can, there's definitely, why am I paying so much for a can? You know, bottling, despite canning being so successful, once you get above a certain price point, people are like, why am I paying £10 for a can of beer? Put it in a bottle, the same beer, and it's automatically worth my money. But yeah, I think definitely choices in design and stuff definitely make people feel it's a more occasion beer. So yeah, that's my, yeah, we definitely do that. But you can talk a little bit about how you guys do it.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one thing I've been thinking about, and I, you know, where does the trend is so strong towards cans, and when you're talking about making inroads at the table, it's hard for me to imagine how that's going to work with presentation, because it's, you know, it's
lacks
not,
the kind of
yeah. There's ceremony and ritual, yeah. and that's part of the experience, and so the experiential part is very important. And people are putting some really great beer in cans, but how that translates into that experience, you know, I'm just not sure. It'd have to get over some kind of perception hump.
And your beers are mostly in 750 champagne bottles.
Right now, exclusively as far as a takeaway package is just 750s. Yeah.
You started canning though recently.
We're gearing up for that. Yeah. Have it canned the first batch. Yet.
Okay. Are those beers going to be offered on site as well, or are those kind of?
Yeah, we don't have any retail experience or any way for people to visit us at the production facility, and obviously the farm is, you know, you know if you're a guest. There's no public-facing place, so we're working on that right now. It'll be done in a couple of months. And so, you know, we're in a very active area with hiking, and so we're right in the foothills of the mountains. So, you know, it's kind of hard to deny the trend, for one, you know, and the obvious benefits of the package, but, you know, the outdoor part, too. It's just something that we feel we're, you know, neglecting by not offering. So still be conditioned and carbonated in the can. But yeah, it's something we're investigating. But so that's where I started thinking about, you know, how does that go with the table part? So we'll never get away from the cork and cage, because it's just...
It's that signifier.
It's just it's the ritual part. And you know, to your other question of how do you... how do you make the inroads, I guess? I think it's on the actual flavors, so that's education of the of staff, which is always difficult for off-site staff at some restaurant here or there. If you get down to what actually tastes better with this dish or with, you know, this type of food, usually it's no contest, you know, but it's being able to...
It's even, you know, getting people to agree to kind of embark on that.
Yeah, you have to. They have to. The actual server has to be able to explain, well, what's best with this. I'm thinking Burgundy, and you're like, no. Really, what you need to have is this, because of this. This was going to really go great together. And
do you find there's a lot of pushback in that moment?
People just can't. Well, I think on the service level, people can't really go there yet. You know, because they don't believe it. And the other problem, obviously, is. In the U.S., you know, with tipping the way it is, so what are you going to make a bigger tip on? You're going to make a better tip on a $40, you know, beer or a $200 bottle of wine? Well, obviously, if you can sell them on the $200 bottle of wine, that means you're making more money. So that's the other barrier, I think, is to, you know, it is on that level.
I think we're going to move to audience questions in a second, but Dan, just to finish us up, can you talk quickly about the various strategies you've used to try to overcome that education gap, the way you work with your servers and front of house to kind of invite people into the fold?
Well, I mean, I think that it's just about getting them to taste things as much as they can and talk them through really simple strategies for understanding things. So, you know, to take the most obvious, when you roast a piece of meat or grill a piece of meat, you are basically sort of starting something called the Maillard reaction. When you sort of char the outside of it, it creates sort of that roasty flavor. And when you're roasting some malts, that you're doing the same type of thing. So, you know, there's an association there. Like, if you think about having a slightly darker, browner beer, it's going to have that similar flavor profile to what you're having when you're having a steak or a roast. And, you know, that's an obvious pairing. So we try and talk them through things like that.
So there's that kind of narrative element.
Yeah, sure, exactly. You just need to make it simple. And the problem, of course, is that people don't necessarily understand what a malt is or, you know, what a hop is. So you just talk them through what those things are, and then in turn they can pass that on relatively simply to a customer. Of course, it's really difficult because, as anyone knows reading the press, like, staffing in the hospitality sector is just incredible. You know, you get a huge churn. We've been pretty good at keeping our staff, very good at it, but you get people leaving, and then you've got somebody else coming in, they'll start, and you need to get them on the floor relatively quickly. And, you know, how do you always ensure they've got the right level of knowledge? Isn't always the easiest thing in the world to do. So, you know, we do put some things on the menu. So, you know, we do that with the wine list, we do that with the beer list. And I think that sometimes it's important that a customer can just read it and, you know, make sense of it just because it's on a page. But generally, it's about breaking it down into a simple narrative, simple explanation of what a flavor is, what's created that flavor profile, and why it might be similar or complementary in another product.
Really extending that hand.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, great. Should we transition to audience questions?
Hello, everybody. Is that actually on? Yeah, cool. Just an observation that maybe volume has an effect in the middle ground of restaurants, that customers aren't prepared to commit to a certain volume of liquid if they're paying a good price for their meal, if that makes any sense. But, you know, if you buy one glass of wine, you're committing to 125 millilitres, whereas if you're for a main course, you're for a beer match, you're committing to 330 mils. And, you know, psychologically, customers may be put off by the fact they've got to consume that within that course. And that would be something that may kind of detract away from it. My other observation was, you know, if you're looking at the premium beer sector and trying to pair things, that perhaps customers aren't aware of what a more premium beer offering might give them. I mean, perceptually, in wine, in Chablis, in Burgundy, things like that, you know, you pay more money, you get more purity of fruit, kind of more quality of flavour. Whereas in beer, the perception to a lesser educated beer person like myself is you're paying for obscurity and rareness and kind of interesting hops and things like that. So maybe a lack of education within the customer base to what the premium beer offering may give you in that environment. Thank you.
Thanks. Have you found that to be the case, that rareness kind of factors in? I think we talked yesterday on a panel about how sort of scarcity is one way to get people to spend money. So by creating a limited edition, you know, annual Lambic or Goes release, that instantly creates value and scarcity that someone can appreciate. Have you found that is the case?
Yeah, it's probably not something that, you know, being candid, that's something that we as a restaurant focus on, particularly sort of niche products. We do have the odd niche beer, but generally that's not been the biggest driver of demand. It can be quite interesting that you put on a really premium bottle and that sells more than a less premium bottle because people find it interesting. But, you know, I think it's not been our key focus. You know, I generally think that the education point, it is more about society as a whole and culture, as you know, our community as a whole. And, you know, you'll see a greater level of interesting beers that pair with wine, that pair with food, as people get more used to seeing craft beer. And what you've had over generations and generations is people just, you know, drinking pints and pints of sometimes quite tasty but not necessarily particularly complex stuff. And as we get more used to having smaller portions of more interesting beer, it'll become more natural to have that with...
We're going to eventually have this sort of sea change, you know, we're immersed enough in this scene.
Right, remember, exactly. But remember also that, you know, pairing wine with food, whilst it's grown up with food in the same way that beer has, like the wine pairing with food thing has only really been around as a movement from like the 70s, 80s, I think. So it's not...
It's funny how entrenched it feels,
right,
and
exactly,
how
exactly.
Immovable.
It's actually relatively modern as, you know, pairing X with Y in a really precise way.
Good to remember that. Are there any other questions? Yeah. Get that hustle.
Do you think there's anything in the ephemerality of beer culture that works against great pairings? I mean, some of the best food and beer pairings, so Noma will commission the beers that they serve in the restaurant. Carrefour Rouge, again, came out of commissioning. The fact that you discover a really great pairing for your meal, and then all these queuers from America have come and bought all of it before you can get any for your restaurant.
Johnny, do you want to take this one as someone who goes out to eat, but also, you know, you probably drink your own beer a lot? Do you find you've stumbled upon pairings, but then something is limited and you kind of can't get it back?
Yeah.
Is that ephemeral thing?
Totally. I mean, we've got a beer dinner next Wednesday, which we are supplying our rainbow beer, which was aged in amphora and there's a Sour Red and Pinot Noir grape skins, and it's a really amazing beer, and we're only keeping that for things like that because, you know, it's it will go really well with food, but we're keeping it for events like that. I think we've not really experienced that kind of situation of people buying all the beer, not at all. But
have you found it on a personal level as well, that frustration when you're going out to eat or cooking at home and you find that perfect pairing, but you know you won't be able to have it in 2 months' time?
Yeah, but I think that's, you know, I think change is, like, having that unique experience is a great thing. Like, I don't think, most of the restaurants I kind of tend to go to tend to have a changing menu, and it's not just, like, we have the same menu all the time. And, I think having, like, events, we tend to, the best events I've done that have had beer involvement have been, the restaurant will say, send us some beer, and we will work around the beer to make a really good pairing for it, rather than the other way around. I find shoehorning in a beer that'll go with a dish is quite difficult. I also find that shoehorning in a beer to, because it's beer, like, I don't want to get into a situation where we're like, wine's bad for food and beer's bad. The best experience I've ever had in restaurants have been education, like you said, and people talking to you, but drinks pairings rather than beer pairings or wine pairings is incredible. There's a restaurant in Berlin called Noble Heart and Schmutzig, and it was the first experience I had of a Michelin star restaurant presenting me with this is the menu and we do a drinks pairing, and it will be cocktails, it will be wines when they're appropriate, it'll be a cider, and here's a Berliner Weiss, and it was amazing. Like, I wouldn't have ordered cider with a certain meal. Like, I mean, we're talking here about beer versus not beer versus wine, but I'd be hard pushed to order a cider at a restaurant, and even though I love cider, but I think it's amazing that when you have someone who can go, the staff, you can go, you know, what works really well with this is a cocktail. And you're like, I would never order a cocktail with dinner.
But I put myself in your hands and let you lead me on this journey.
And I think there is a certain consumer who will agree with that, and other people will just be like, nah, just give me the safest option. And I think we're dealing with a niche, you know, sector of the market, but. Yeah, I think drinks pairings is the future. I think getting to that stage where people are just like, I want what goes best with the food. And we're back to the guy. I don't think we answered the guy at the back's question about drink serving size being put off. I think there's definitely room for, you know, bottles to be recorked and of beer and to be served by the glass. It's definitely the future, and it's possible. But there's also a huge market of people buying bottles of wine to go with their meal, mm-hmm. rather than just buy the glass. So I don't think it's anything we need to be worried about.
Great. Do we, one more?
Does anyone sort of understand why, if you go to a food and drink event, a food and drink festival, there's very rarely breweries present? Why do you think the breweries don't take these as a good marketing opportunity?
I don't know. That what I spoke to before is those are the kind of events that we typically do. Like, we think if we can, you know, there's a one in Florida called, you know, 30A, and it's a wine festival, and we're the only beer there, and people really, you know, wake up to it. And we have a lot of success when you know, you're at the beer festival, you've got the other half of the couple that says, I don't really drink beer, and we're like, well, we got this one, you should try us, you know, Asian Rhone barrels, and, you know, I think you'll like it. And, you know, you see the eyes light up when they taste it, like, well, yeah, I do like beer. I guess I do like beer. I didn't know that before. So, you know, we try and get in some of those other avenues that are, you know, like I said, we'll be the only brewery there, and that's fine with us, you know, so that works well. And, but as far as brewers at the festival, you know, I think part of it's the demands on time. There's so many now as well. You know, it's this hard to be everywhere at once. You know, when I started doing this 20 plus years ago, there was in my town there was one a year, and now there's 15 a year. So you know.
That requires a huge amount of coordination and work.
Yeah, and you got to look at the return. Is it worth doing? And a lot of them aren't. You know, the facts, a lot of them aren't. So, you know, that seems to be on the festival side of focus too. Is everybody's trying to figure out how they can be more special than the other, you know, than the other events that really provide a draw. Because we've also seen attendance drop at some festivals that had 7,500 people there, and then they're kind of giving tickets away at the end because they can't fill the thing up. And yeah, maybe speaks to the larger the industry as a whole, you know.
Totally.
People
are
reaching see growth slowing down because now everybody's got, you know, an option there and a local brewery. So
great. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. So please join me in giving a hand to our panelists today. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for listening, folks. We hope to see you at the Extravaganza again next year. Who knows what lies ahead for the industry, its culture, and the many challenges and opportunities that will present themselves along the way. But sure enough, we'll be ready to dig in and talk about it from a variety of perspectives around the world. And the Beavertown Extravaganza will be the perfect venue for it. Aim true, pour liberal. We'll see you next year.